Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Well, the politics of the Massachusetts fishing industry is as contentious as it is long. Lawmakers just last week demanded some $96 million from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for what they called excessive fines slapped on Bay State fishermen. Meanwhile, senators and congressmen applauded a U.S. Department of Commerce decision to increase catch limits on pollock, easing restrictions on the fishing fleet. So all this news is especially important, of course, in Gloucester, where for centuries, fishing has been inseparable from the life of the city. And the interesting thing is that same push-pull between financial pressures and dwindling stocks is what brought to an end a previous era in Gloucester, an era in which 200-pound halibut were caught by fearless men in tiny, flat-bottomed wooden boats. Those boats were called dories, and John Morris, grandson of a dory fisherman, has written a new book entitled Alone at Sea, Gloucester in the Age of the Dorymen, 1623 to 1939. John Morris, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, I have to say, on the cover of your book, you have this spectacular painting of a dory boat. It looks like two men in a small vessel at quite a distance from the main fishing ship. So can you describe for listeners who may not know, what is it that a dory actually looked like?
Well, a dory is about 16 to 20 feet long, so it's not very big. It sits a couple feet out of the water with a flat bottom, and two men would sit there. They could be anywhere from a half a mile to a mile away from the schooner, and up to a half a mile to a mile away from anybody else. What they had to do now was catch fish. And how did they do it? Did they drop single lines over the side, as you or I might do today? No way. They had these big buckets that were filled with lines with hundreds and hundreds of hooks. And an anchor would bring that line to the bottom, and they would row across the fishing ground for up to a mile, dropping the line as they went along. At the other end, there'd be another anchor and another buoy. And now there'd be 1 mile of line set out on the bottom of the sea. That schooner that went with them had 12 dories that did that, and they were each about a half a mile to a mile apart.
So the dorymen are in this tiny little boat. They were connected to those buoys, but were they connected to the schooner in any way?
Absolutely not. This is a time before any radio communication. When the weather would turn bad, the schooner man might take a big mallet and hit on metal that was on the vessel. They might go up into the rigging with a lighted torch or a lighted bucket so the men could see them. It was not unusual for these men to get separated from the schooners, and they could be out there 1, 2, 3 days without being seen. They might actually be picked up by another schooner. Sometimes they rowed the wrong way and were never seen again.
Wow. Yeah, I'm looking at a picture here of one of those dories. It looks like it's loaded up with its catch. Is that halibut?
That's halibut, and halibut could weigh 2, 3 to as much as 500 pounds. These were huge things, standing as tall as a man. And my grandfather was one of the men who did this for most of his fishing career, over 40 years, pulling those fish up, and sort of amazing.
It is remarkable to think that they're out there in the middle of the Atlantic, can't really see very far away, might be shrouded in fog, and they're hauling up 200-pound fish into this small little flat-bottom boat.
And whacking it with a big stick to make sure it didn't flap around too much and knock them overboard, because that was one of the things they were worried about. They had to watch for waves, they had to worry about the fish, they had to worry about this line they're pulling up with all the hooks in it. Very difficult sort of activity to pull it off right, so you came back alive.
And this is all happening in the 19th century. And you'd mentioned your grandfather, who himself was a dorymen, and that's what got you interested in this story. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, his name was Steve Olson. He came here as a young man with five other guys from a small island on the west coast of Sweden called Gullholmen. They were all fishermen. So they came here, and one of the first things these guys did when they got to Gloucester was actually go out dory fishing, but not off of New England, off of Iceland. They spent the summer fishing off of Iceland because the halibut fisheries had got rather scarce here. They'd been overfishing. And so my grandfather got into a schooner in March or April and came back in September and October. Amazing.
Huh. And what happened to him?
He drowned. He spent 43 years as a Gloucester doryman at the age of 63. When pulling in halibut, he drowned on what's called St. Pierre's Bank off the southern coast of Newfoundland. And this is 1935. It's rough weather. They're pulling in the fish. The schooner came by and took the first load off. And then he left them as he went to the others. When he came back, the dory had disappeared. They eventually, the next day, found the dory. The only thing they found of the two men was my grandfather's glove.
Well, you'd mentioned that your grandfather had come to Gloucester in the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
This is around the same time, or maybe even just after, other waves of immigrants had come to Gloucester, and really, these were the men who became the dorymen of Gloucester. Who were they, and why did they come to Gloucester to become fishermen?
First, why did they come? Right after the Civil War, dory fishing, as I've described it, blossomed in Gloucester. And as it did, the fleet expanded, and there was just the need for new young men to do this. And these were young men. They were tended to be in their 20s, very strong, coming from fishing communities. They came from the Azores. And so we have a lot of Portuguese fishermen coming up from the Azores. They came from the Azores on whalers to New Bedford and got on trains to Boston, and took the train from Boston to Gloucester, put their bags into a boarding house, walked the waterfront, and looked for a job on a schooner. And so we had the Azorean men come. We had them come down from Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, lots of these men. These men did something a little different, the Azorean men. When they came from the Azores, or like my grandfather from Sweden or Norway, you stayed in Gloucester. Very few of them ever left. If you were in Nova Scotia or Newfoundland, some of the men would come down for half a year. So they might work the summer, or they might work the winter. But a lot of them settled permanently in Gloucester and became a part of the fabric of the community. The last group of immigrants we had were the Italian fishermen. They came in around 1910, 1912.
It's easy to picture sort of the heroic skipper of the schooner standing on the deck of the ship out there in the ocean. Maybe a little harder to picture the day-to-day challenges that the dorymen themselves had to face. So what was the relationship like between the skippers and the dorymen?
The skipper was boss once they were at sea. On land, he would give them their money once he sold the fish. They might go drinking together. They might live near one another. But at sea, he was the boss. And the men listened very religiously to whatever he had to say. Their survival depended on it. He would decide how much sail to put on. He would decide what risk to take. He would decide if the men got lost to go and pick them up or to leave them there.
But on the other hand, if it weren't for the dorymen, the skipper would have no reason to be out there because they weren't the ones actually pulling in the fish. So how did the skipper value the work that the dorymen were doing?
He valued it greatly. And the skipper's also got a huge sense of commitment to the men. I have a story in there about a man named Carl Olson, the man who was a skipper of the vessel my grandfather drowned on. And Carl, as a young skipper, became a great highliner in Gloucester. And by the time the 20s are coming, he's one of the most respected skippers in the port. He's going to be eventually one of the last of the great highliners in the 40s. He's single, and he's living with a man in his mid-50s, a guy named Niels Christensen. And Niels was basically a rigger, would go up and tie masts and fix sails and whatever. But he sometimes would go out on a trip. And he went out on this trip, his last dory going over the side, and for some reason a wave hit the dory, and Christensen goes into the water. He can't swim. He's being held up only by his things. And Carl Olson just yells to the cook, the only other man on the boat, "I'm going for him."
Wow. John Morris, you've actually written about this exact story in your book, Alone at Sea. Can you read us a little passage about what happened when Captain Olson actually dove overboard to save this dorymen?
Sure can. So as the captain swam towards the dorymen, he removed his oversized rubber boots and shouted encouragement, "Hang on, Chris, I'm coming." A strong swimmer, Olson quickly closed the distance between himself and Nielsen. But the doryman was not a strong swimmer. He was not even a regular seaman. He was a rigger. Only the ear in Nielsen's oilskins was keeping him afloat. His waterlogged rubber boots were pulling him down, and he was becoming numb in the cold water. But he was fighting to survive. Olson continued to shout words of encouragement, closing the distance to his floundering mate. On reaching him, he helped him, placed one hand on his shoulder, and had him climb on his back. He told him, "If you don't go home, I won't go home either." Olson held Nielsen close to his back and swam toward the approaching schooner, which by then had turned and was making for them. But then Olson spied parts from the overturned dory on the crest of a rising wave, and left Nielsen to make for two floating oars. He reached them in an instant and pushed them back toward his friend, foot by foot, through the rising swell. Once alongside, he passed one oar to Chris and kept one for himself. The two tired men now kept afloat without having to extend themselves. By now, the dorymen and the last of the dories to have been set saw the men bobbing in the water. Leaving their gear, they rowed frantically to their shipmates. The two waterlogged fishermen were soon hauled onto the dory and then onto the schooner.
That's John Morris reading from his book, Alone at Sea. Let me ask you, if you look out on Gloucester Harbor today, you see one schooner, maybe.
The Adventure, that's it.
Of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds that used to ply the waters of the Atlantic, what is it that brought the age of the dorymen to a close then?
Several things. One, we overfished, and they recognized that. And that was a big concern to the 19th and earliest 20th century to Gloucester fishermen. And there was lots of talk about it. And the government was doing research going back into the 19th century, trying to understand what the banks were like, where the fish were, et cetera. Then there came the power vessels. And the power vessels came into Boston around 1906, 1907. Gloucester did not adopt them quickly and fought against them, as a matter of fact, because instead of laying line across the bottom, they dragged huge nets across the bottom, scooping up everything that they could. And it was only in the First World War the economics became good enough for the Gloucester men to join this. And then they went in with both feet.
Do you know when the last dory fishermen were out at sea?
Yeah, we do. Joe Gowan has a great book on the schooner Adventure. She is the last of the dory fishermen. And it's great that she still exists as a vessel in Gloucester. So the last of the dory fishermen is still there, and these are wooden vessels. It took a lot of upkeep to maintain them. But the very last one was the Adventure, 1953.
Well, you definitely bring their memory to life in this book. As I said, I can just see in my mind's eye the image of two men in a flat-bottomed wooden boat out there in the middle of the ocean. So thank you so much for bringing us their story today.
I'd love to. It's been a great pleasure being here and even more fun writing the book.
Well, that's John Morris. He's author of Alone at Sea, Gloucester in the Age of the Dorymen. Coming up, the 2010 oil spill in the Gulf is, of course, one for the tragic record books, but a 1969 spill in Falmouth teaches us just how much of that history lies beneath the surface even decades later. That's coming up after a short break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.